The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Folks, it is 4:10. I would like to honor our time today and give you as much time as possible at the end of this session to ask questions. That's what we're all here about, and I'd like to honor that. As the last of us come in the room, just find a comfy spot. Let's open with prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity to be here. We thank you for the opportunity to hear so many speakers and to converse with so many new friends and so many compatriots on the road, so many people we can walk with as we get this chance to engage you through the nature of our jobs, through our vocations. Lord, thank you for this calling, thank you for this profession, and thank you for the special visions that we get to cast into it because we see you underneath, within, throughout. And Lord, we thank you especially for this 4 o'clock session in the afternoon. Lord, as we keep it real, help us to lift up our own minds, and as we have them so full of things, help us to make room for a couple more. And Lord, we thank you for all of this in Jesus' name. Amen. Guys, thank you for attending a 4 o'clock session in the semi-dark. Hopefully I will not push you to sleep. I work with 6th graders and elementary school students, so if we take stretch breaks throughout, it's perfectly normal on my day. Just to get an idea, before I even introduce and talk a little bit about what we're doing, let me see a show of hands. I always like to know who my audience is. How many of you in this room are grammar school teachers or elementary teachers? Wow. Okay. How about logic and rhetoric school teachers, middle school, high school type? Okay. How many of you are administrators? God bless you. And let's see. How many of you have kids of your own? Okay. Good. That puts it in perspective. Okay. So a quick, by way of introduction, I'll introduce myself, and then I will talk about this topic here. This is my first time at ACCS. I've been an SCL guy for a long time, and it's just an honor to be here. I've heard so much about this conference through the years. It's a wonderful thing to be standing here and sitting with you, as I have been all day, hearing about the wonderful things that are going on here. I have a wonderful wife of 13 years who's anxiously waiting for me to come home because we have 3 sons, 6th grade, 4th grade, and 2nd grade. She's a champ. She's been waiting it out in Central Virginia with all the heavy thunderstorms that have been rolling through there. I'm an academic dean at the Covenant School in Charlottesville, Virginia. This is my 21st year in education. I started in public school. I went to secular independent school, very rigorous college prep. And across the last 5 years, for the first time, I've matched my vocation with my vocation and come into classical education. It's been a wonderful journey. And I started, just like you guys, from the ground and worked my way up. None of us were educated this way, right? Very few of us are young enough in this room to be said that we've gone all the way through to K-12 in that. And as we reclaim this, what I want to do today is continue a conversation that was started just a few years back. And we find ourselves at this great place in the continuum where we can continue this conversation from the get-go. We're building from the ground up. And that involves, in a lot of cases, kind of a reclamation. We have to look at what was lost. We're at the Restoring the Ruins conference, and we have to figure out how to put it back together, but in such a way that it matches up with what God is calling us to do, right? What our vocations are. And that was the impetus behind the talk I'm about to provide for you guys today, The Power of Observation, Stopping the Outsourcing of Perception. It's a strange kind of title if you roll it around in your head. But I think by the end of this session, you're going to see where I'm going with this and maybe a little bit of how it might flavor the conversation. By way of other introduction, the other reason I'm standing up here in front of you is because I'm a small-scale farmer. Right, I opted out of the suburban life. I was a suburban kid. I grew up there. I came to the woods. My wife and I homesteaded a farm. We lived in a tent for 2 years. My first son came from the hospital to that tent. So we've lived third world for a while here in America. I'm a hunter and tracker. I'm a musician and sketch artist. And every single one of those threads plays into what I'm about to talk to you today. So if you have a focal practice yourself, if you're a gardener or a walker, or you're a nature photographer, or you're just someone who likes to use your senses in certain ways, I think you're going to resonate with what this is, and I encourage you to bring your talents to the table. There's a reason why you have them. So, first off, let's do some observing ourselves. What do you see? Oil painting, someone said right away. Okay, how do you tell it's an oil painting? Smudges? Yeah. It's either oil paint or it's something next to a third grader's lunch. Somewhere along the line. Okay. So let me give you a little bit of perspective on this and see if you can get it now. I hear some. I just see the heads going up and down. All right? Can we resolve a form in here now? Okay. Could we hear? Not particularly. How about now? Okay. What we're doing is we're zooming in on Surratt's quantalism. If you go right in here inside that lady's umbrella, all right, see her in the middle there, and go right to the stem of the umbrella. That's what you're looking at. Okay. Dots. Colored dots. And I'm going to encourage you to start thinking about your kids, especially you grammar school teachers, as people who perceive a lot of colored dots. They don't yet have enough perspective, perhaps, to step back and even know there's a painting out there, right? We can. We've done the journey. And in fact, as people who are reclaiming Christian classical education, we're still learning about the painting ourselves. We just know there is one, and we're kind of moving towards it gradually, bit by bit. But if you start thinking about the way the kids perceive, not just with sight, but with other senses too, I think you'll get an understanding of why we need to kind of reframe science. If we teach science so it remains this, then they will never get to this, much less this. And so we've got to think about how to go from those points all the way up into a cohesive picture, a coherent picture that has narrative, it's got story, it's got poetry. So how to do this? Well, first, let's look at our goals as Christian classical science educators. What do we want to do? Well, we want to graduate the most technically skilled, competent science students. That's got to be our, the parents are paying for it. We know we have to do this. It's wise to do it. Oh, and it ever, right? Because God is calling us to do this. We can't just say, well, we'll be satisfied with halfway there. We've really got to make sure that we do this the right way. We've got to go deep, which means they've got to know the facts and the figures, the skills, the procedures, everything there. But they've got to know something more. There's got to be something about this education that allows them to do science in a culture that is somewhat hostile to Christian faith. We're making Daniels, guys. Right? You remember the story of Daniel? Right? They're conquered and they're getting taken all the way back to Babylon. And God says, hold, I have plans to prosper you. But when you get there, build houses and plant trees. Because you're going to be there a long time. Right? We've seen across the last few hundred years the centers of Christianity moving away from the cultural center, the thing that defines the laws, the norms, the references, to the edge and the outskirts. And now other things have taken over that piece, postmodernism and other pieces that those of you with philosophy degrees like me, we could talk about all night. But suffice to say that we find ourselves now not in the center of things. And so we have to help our children who are going to be scientists, who are going to be good scientists, become good Daniels, because they're going to be working with that culture. And we have to do it in a different way. Because if we teach science the same way our secular counterparts do, then we're leaving the door open for certain imported philosophies to make their way in that are not necessarily what we want in the heads and minds and hearts and practices of our kids. This is the great challenge. And to do this, we've got to look at three pieces in my mind. One of them is narrative. What is the very story by which we even put science in our curriculum? Why are we doing this? It's not just to get a job, right? There's a lot more to this. The telos. How many of you know what I mean by the word telos when I throw it out there? Okay, good. This is a new piece of Greek for you. Telos means the end. You teach with the end in mind. Where are you going with this? It's not just the story of your practice, but it's where you're going. Who are you aiming for? Notice the who. And finally, liturgy. Liturgy. And that's something we do in church. Yes, it is. Liturgy is the way you participate in the service, right? The order of the service, the times when you genuflect, the times when you approach the altar, the time when you shake hand with someone else for the peace. Right? All of these are part and parcel of a liturgy, a process of embodied movement throughout the church service that I want you to start thinking about in terms of your classroom. What are the practices that your students engage in that aim them towards a certain narrative and a certain end with science? It's more than just lab procedures, although they are part of the liturgy. The question is, what else is? So for those of you who are looking for a practitioner class, we're going to get to that. But I've got to start you with a little bit of this to get your head around the why before we talk about the how, even at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Right? So we've got to actively engage these questions about what good science pedagogy is. That's our job. Right? As science teachers and as faithful Christians, this is where we have to come at this. And there's no one else there who can just hand you a book and say, well, here it is. There are guys who write good textbooks, right? John Mays, Novari Press, Robbie Jane is in the process of doing a number of things for people. We can point to folks who have some inkling of this, an idea, but we're still kind of figuring it out. And you guys are right on the cusp of that. Because of that, we have to do something that a great philosopher, James K. Smith, calls reform the formers. We have to look at ourselves. None of us was taught science in a Christian classical way. Right? So we have to look at the things in our own practice. We can't just teach that same way. We've got to look into those practices and see what really makes them go. So you might imagine this is an entire college course worth of material right here. But we're going to look at one thing today, and that's the senses. Because you work in a grammar school, our youngest kids are primed to sense the world. It's what they come to the world with. God gives you senses from the time that you're a baby. Your rationality takes time to form in there. But your senses are there from the get-go, and for a reason. Right? He's asking you to look into the world to perceive his order from the very early times. And we know when you're holding a baby, if things are disordered around a baby, the baby cries. When the baby has order, baby's content. And imagine that extends now all the way out. Right? We have younger children in our classrooms who are not babies. They're developing some logic, but they're still gathering information through their senses. And there are stories to be told there. So let's do an exercise. Lab time. The exercise is, you have 6 minutes to sketch your thumb. Now, when I do this in my class, it's 15 minutes, but you all paid for this, so I'm not going to cheat you on that. 6 minutes is good enough to get the point of the exercise and go, there's only two rules to this. One, silence your phone and place it so that it's screen down. No drifting thumb to, like, poke the text in there, right? You got to keep that out of the mix. And second, you may not communicate with anyone for any reason at any time during this activity, with the possible exception of situations involving spontaneous combustion, right? Monastic practice is important for this one. You've got to go internal, right? Stop your outward flow and your output and go on input. Does everybody have a tool ready to do this one? Okay. On your mark, get set, go. Time. Finish up your last details, and like the kids, finish up that last piece of the essay. So now that you've had this meditative experience, you're going to turn and talk to a partner, because we're going to unpack this one to get to the point of the exercise. What did you notice about blank during the experience? And I want you to fill in your conversation with your partner two things for that blank. How you saw. And second, what happened in your mind? You got about 30 seconds to talk this over with a partner. Go for it. Five, four, three, two, one. Wrap up that conversation. Love how we've got that continued flow to us by this time of day as people wrap up ideas. I'll do like I do with the kids. I'm going to hold up a hand. Thank you. Thank you in the back row. Thank you in the front row. Thank you for all. What happened, right? How did you see? Did anyone notice a change in the way that you saw over that time? No? A little more detail, okay? That's usually one that pops out. We stop looking after a certain amount of time. We start seeing. There's a difference between those two. Right? Americans have very good active looking skills. We're good at looking. We're not so good at seeing. What happened in your mind? Yeah, we'll go back to that in a minute. But peace, quiet, and tranquility. You notice that all of a sudden, like, it's like muddy water in a glass, right? You shake it up when you're in. Before you start all this stuff, the mud is in suspension. And then if you give it a couple of minutes, it kind of trickles to the bottom and things get real clear. start to see what's going on. Okay, so hold that kind of in your head. Right? And if you didn't experience those things, one of my favorites, I watch someone in this room, and I will not point out who it is. About 30 seconds, I'm done. Right? It's the same thing the kids do, too. And I have a sign up on my board that has the universal no symbol, that circle with the red thing that says, I'm done. And every time I see that, I go, okay, right back to it. I highly recommend you make one. It's very useful. And you don't even have to disturb the flow. So let me ask you, if I change the parameters of this activity a little bit, how might it have been different? Right? For example, if I told you a lot about the mechanics of thumbs beforehand, how might it have been different? Right? Just think about this inside your head for a moment. What if we pulled up pictures of thumbs online and looked at those for the same amount of time? The same 6 minutes. What if I told you what to expect in terms of the movement of your mind? Now, guys, in about 2 minutes, you're going to notice that things will start to, you know. All right. How does that change this experience? Well, if you've got ideas in your head about that, that actually primes you to learn about this guy, Louis Agassiz. Louis Agassiz was a very famous biologist and geologist. He was also a person who took exception to Darwin's mechanisms of evolution. He's a person you probably might want to look up. Agassiz, of course, you might be able to tell by those awesome sideburns, was in the last century, 1800s, 2 centuries ago now. I'm still that age. But he had this fantastic course at his university to take graduate students. And you can go look up the specifics of the story I'm about to tell you. He would put his students through essentially the same exercise I did with you, except he'd give them a fish. He put this big fish on the table, and he'd tell them the genus name. This is a homelon, I think it was. It was a deep-sea kind of fish, one of the first ones that they had. And he plops down a bottle of preserving alcohol and a brush and a sketch pad, and he says, okay, I want you to spend some time with the fish. I'll be back. And he leaves the lab. And, of course, the kid's sitting in there with this fish on a table, and he's got to dab the alcohol on it, right? And he's kind of sketching the fish and going. And a lot of time goes by, and he wonders where Dr. Agassiz went. So he goes out and he asks Dr. Agassiz and says, oh, he's gone to dinner. He'll be back in a while. Oh, great. Okay. So I'm stuck here with this fish. And his mind, right, the graduate student's mind, goes through the same things that your, you know, the five stages of grief, essentially. What you guys have said, you got to like this and then denial and then acceptance, finally. As you go. But you watch what happens to this. And the student recounts it. He said, well, I was looking at this fish for an hour and I was keeping it wet the way he told me to. And then all of a sudden I noticed this really cool thing about the gill flap. And then it goes. And all of a sudden, the kid loses himself in the process of observing this fish. Dr. Agassiz comes back 6 hours later. And the guy says, the only thing I noticed was really the first hour I was in here, right after that. And still, the guy didn't get it up to Dr. Agassiz's standards. He says, you totally missed this thing in the eye. It's right there in front of you. You're going to come back again tomorrow and do this. Right? What Agassiz was doing was apprenticing this student in seeing. And notice that perception piece, right? This is called the outsourcing of perception because oftentimes our kids have their perception totally outsourced. We let other people kind of do it for us. They tell us what we're supposed to see, and then we see it. But if we get recentered, if we onshore our perceptions again, right, and turn this into a domestic enterprise, then all of a sudden we've done something for ourselves that we might otherwise have missed. This is the cultivation of something I call never just vision. And I actually stole this a little bit from Isaac Newton, right? This is a quote by him. To myself, I'm only a child playing on the beach, while vast oceans of truth lie undiscovered before me. Isaac Newton, one of the greatest physicists of all times, right? This guy who wrote the Principia and the optics, he co-invented calculus. He sees there's so much more to this than just what he can see and put his hands on and observe. And if our kids get little touches and glimpses of that as they go along, I think we're connecting them to something a little bit bigger. Incidentally, a lot of you might not know this, but Newton spent the last 30 years of his life doing theology. You won't hear that in the public school classroom. He'll talk about how he was a model of scientific efficiency. But that last 30 years is really something for him. It was mildly heretical theology. If you're interested in that kind of thing, go look it up. But Newton said, God is mechanics. He's working in here. There are things that are going on in the order of providence. He's looking into the Logos, right? And so he spends 30 years of his time doing such things. Let's look at Solomon's wisdom. Right, here's another character who we think is very wise. And this is out of 1 Kings 4. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that's in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. And if those of you who are gardeners might know hyssop, it's a very small plant. Right? It's very diminutive. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. Men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. And it goes on. We have some other pieces there. Solomon is a natural scientist. Look at what he's got here. By observing these things, these natural phenomena, he's actually gaining certain kinds of wisdom that allow him to become a good ruler. And people are looking at him from the outside. These are other people describing his wisdom and what's attractive about it. Right? Here he is. So if we want our students to engage such things, we have to turn back to something that's been lost in time, and that is the process of natural philosophy. This is not just science. Natural science, looking into nature through experimentation, is one kind, one element to natural philosophy. But the other is what I just put you through, natural history, which is actually making some really good, deep observations. And once you put the two together in an ethical framework, a moral framework, a telos that binds them together, then all of a sudden, we have something that's a lot bigger than just science. This is a reclamation of something that's been lost. It's poetic. It involves a resonance, a tuning between the things you can experiment with, you observe. Right? And by doing this, we're looking directly into that divine reason and creative order. Not just facts and figures, not just how to dissect, but some really deep things about the order of this cosmos. You might notice that modern scientists use the term universe to describe what we're in. I like cosmos. Does anyone know why? Cosmos has an implication. Cosmos is an implication. Universe is, there's one of them. Universe, right? Everything's in it. Cosmos has an implication of order. It's the thing, the container, and everything in it that's been ordered in a certain way. And we've kind of lost that in a bit. So how do we get away from this? I will not belabor the point, but I'm going to tell you in 5 quick bullet points, the ancient Greeks and medievals had this. If you look at what the ancient Greeks, I teach my kids these hand motions to remember what they thought. The ancient Greeks, it was, they're looking into creation around them because they perceive the handiwork of the gods, right? If we get ourselves there, we can conform ourselves to that, and we'll do better because of it, right? We're tuning ourselves to the music that the gods have written into the rest of the cosmos. For the medievals, it was worship. This was the book of nature. We look into nature in order to understand what God has done, and it's awesome. Well, the Enlightenment came along, and again, very brief history, man became a measure. There was a little shift in the way that we looked at things. And as Francis Bacon in 1620 kind of enshrined those principles in the Novum Organum, this is where we get knowledge is power, that saying amongst others, then all of a sudden we began to capture the popular imagination by the elimination of drudgery. Right? Think about what happened when the steam locomotive came along and all of a sudden people didn't have to pull things by hand or by oxen. And what happened when we started to cure diseases, right? None of these are bad, disordered things in their own right. However, people said, gosh, this natural science is giving us all this awesome stuff. The way that they do that natural science is probably really important. Maybe we should apply the rules of that to just about everything. Because look at what it's doing here. Ugh. Right? Build a car by engineering, but don't engineer your relationships. See the difference? And there's really the piece about scientism, right? As the disciplines got more and more specialized, and more scientia, knowledge became more and more specialized in this PhD about biology, now there were 11 categories, where before there was just one guy in the medieval times who could know everything, right? Everything was in the same mind. Then all of a sudden, they no longer talked. The biologist didn't talk to the geologist, didn't talk to the chemist, didn't, except for maybe on a little project here or there. But even the vocabulary they use is different. If you take a modern PhD in physics, a specialized PhD in, say, nuclear physics, and put them in a room with a specialized biologist, they have a completely different vocabulary once you get past about the 300-level courses in their undergrad work. And that's part of the problem with this, as they specialize. And then finally, in our country, Dewey, James, and American pragmatic philosophers came in and said, you know what, you only need to know the facts, because we really need you to be good at being a factory worker, or perhaps managing people in the factory. And to do that, you really just need the facts. And so we're going to start testing you. Oh, and we're going to create grades, because grades are really important. We need to know whether you're in third grade or sixth grade or 10th grade, And that's really important to us because that tells us how far along in the absorbing of this content you've gotten. Does anybody realize, like, Friedrich Froebel came up with this idea called kindergarten? It was a garden. And then all of a sudden we went to grades. Ah, 1 year difference. Think about it. Wouldn't it be cool if a garden went all the way up? That's what I think. So, yeah, let's take a look at this one, okay? Biblical sense of the senses, because we want to root this back. If we're going to start looking at liturgies, we're going to start looking at narrative, let's go to the Bible and see this. Eyes to see and ears to hear. It's straight out of the gospel on this. Now, granted, Christ is talking about deeper truths here. Right? He's talking about allegorical parable. But this is kind of important, the way he uses the senses in the Gospels. Oftentimes healing occurs around the senses. Think about Ephatha, Mark 7, right? I open you. I open the senses that you may see and perceive. Even healing. Think about a paralytic, right? Having been partially paralyzed myself, and you've seen me go through this. So I had a hip replacement last year, and I had a nerve palsy. It's a 1 in 5,000 condition. It happens every once in a while. I should have played the lottery. And my right leg was paralyzed just for a little while. It totally shut down the muscle. And, of course, being a good science teacher, I'm like, wow, paralysis. I'm poking around on there. I think this will come back. But in the meantime, I'm kind of doing a little experiment and figuring out what's going on. And what I realize is paralysis means you can't feel. You can't feel. There are no longer these electrical impulses being sent, connecting your whatever to your brain to allow you to feel. And think about how much of our life depends upon feeling, right? And so a lot of our embodied practices, that Ephatha really counts here. We're in the business of Ephatha here as science educators. We want to reopen those senses in a godly way. Now, we also have to understand that these senses are broken, right? The fall has done this to us. They cannot fully be trusted. And that's really important to give kids, right? You don't want to follow your senses. I really want to do this thing that feels really good. No, you don't, because you don't really understand the implication of that just yet. Okay, think about teenagers here. You also have to understand that little kids can be fooled by this. Okay, magic tricks are awesome to little kids because it fools the eye, fools the ear. So we have to kind of teach them that we have to use our senses in an orderly way. We've got to use these things in such a way that we're honoring God by doing it. Think about the Garden of Eden. What a sense paradise this must have been. And here we were. The first task we were given was to name things and simply to enjoy it. This was the first garden that cultivated itself. They didn't have to weed. It did itself. This is awesome. What an awesome sensory experience this must have been. And yet, because we wanted to become gods, we now have to work by the sweat of our brow, and our senses are a little bit disordered. I showed this picture to my children, incidentally, before I came here, and my youngest, who's going into second grade, goes, Dad, that looks like it smells like a zoo. And I said, Son, it was the Garden of Eden. I'm pretty sure it didn't. I think we're okay there, right? I'm sure those smells came later. So if we go through history and look at this even more, look at Augustine, Doctrina Christiana, for those of you who are scholars of church fathers or take a look back in there. Beauty beckons to us from an object, right? Their whole concept of beauty here, and if you go to St. Thomas Aquinas, right, we'll dictate this in the Summa too, another 800 years on. So beauty beckons to us. Beauty is a quality that pulls on us from an object. Wow, that is beautiful. You want to spend time with it. You want to continue sensing it, whatever it is, a good piece of music, something that smells good, right? That coffee smell in the lobby this morning was beckoning to me. And for those of you who teach physics, you have to understand that beauty is a vector. A vector is a quantity with direction, okay? Or it's a force with a direction. Think about a race car on a track. It can go 200 miles an hour all day long. But if the track is circular, has it gone anywhere all day? No. That's kind of like modern science. It goes 200 miles an hour in a circle. It never breaks out of that track. But if you're calculating its velocity, right, you have to look at how far it's actually traveled. That race car has gone 200 miles all day long, but it hasn't gone anywhere. Its velocity is zero, even though its speed is 200. Right, it goes very fast, but no direction. And so we have to aim our kids in a direction. We have to give them that telos so that it becomes a velocity. So here's where I actually start to get down to activities. And thank you for walking through philosophy. I think you maybe will understand why it's so important to think about that now. Because if we don't catch those parts and understand what's underneath all this, then it just becomes activities. And rather than handing you a fish like Agassiz, I'd rather teach you to fish. First pedagogical point. Avoid telling students what they will sense before they sense it. Unless it's a matter of safety. Okay? Right? Avoid telling students what they will sense before they sense it. And I'm going to illustrate this through discovery. Here's two little stories, and I actually use these with my own faculty back at school. Two science classes are learning about gardening, right? How many of you have gardens at your schools? Okay, if I came back next year, it would be awesome to see all of your hands up, because what an awesome thing a garden is, even if it's a container garden. Grow a tomato plant in a pot, seriously. Two science classes are learning about gardening. The first class learns the facts and figures about the garden in the classroom, then goes on a tour of the garden, which has been prepared by others, probably parent volunteers, right? They may be given a scavenger hunt to cite examples of the facts they've learned in class. How much looking is going on here versus seeing? Okay, the teacher has primed the pump with a series of things to look for, and therefore, they're a lot like tourists driving through a national park with the windows up. Right? They don't really see the garden or experience it other than at arm's length. They may be excellent lookers, but they won't get it. They may remark that it's pretty, but they're not going to get an abiding sense of the beauty of it. They'll be beckoned by it, perhaps, but they won't have a complete set of tools to follow that beckoning back to its source. You front-loaded them with facts, and so that's what they see. They are this. I have given you a pair of science blinders composed of these two worksheets you need to fill out, and therefore you see what's in front of you. Right? You're going to miss all that peripheral. Now, in the second class, students start class in the garden. Not in the classroom, but actually out there. First and foremost, they've planted it themselves, maybe in the spring before when they were in a younger grade. They've now returned in the fall to weed and water, tasks that were shared with parent, staff, and student volunteer groups across the summer, and they're there to observe how things have changed. They've been given paper and pencil and told to pick a single plant of their own choosing to sketch for the next 15 minutes. After 15 minutes of contemplation and observation, students are gathered back together, still in the midst of the lab. We don't go back to the classroom to do this. We're going to sit in the garden and do it, to share what they observed. And from these observations, connections with biology, chemistry, physics, and earth science are drawn. And the facts and figures are then presented within the context of real experience aimed at a telos. What drew you to this plant in particular is a starting point, right? That question. You're opening with a question, not a statement. Plants can be revisited to tease out that wonder. Oh, you saw this? Hey, let's go over and check that out together. Everybody, come on. Let's see it. And, of course, there'll be more questions at the end of this class than there was at the beginning, which is exactly the way we want it. Right? Ponder the way that comes out. So don't prime the pump with too much. Let the pump prime itself. Let them observe and create questions that will well up naturally from inside. A curiosity kind of drives it. Do not do it in a Deweyan sense. The Deweyan sense is, well, whatever you want to learn, that's what you should learn. Be a mentor. Have a framework. Know where you're going with this generally, but entertain the individuality of the kids and their explorations. And in such a way, you're going to get this resonance that builds up where you get what you need done, they get what they need done, and it's all done in the service of something bigger. Pedagogical point number two. Consider the effects of electronic technology and immersion on the senses. Consider the effects of electronic technology and immersion on the senses. I am no Luddite. I love technology. I do. But in a certain way. Okay? Use it mindfully. Let me show you what I mean by that. There was a kid, and I'm borrowing this straight out of the Mars Hill Audio Journal. If any of you do not have a subscription to that, make yourself a birthday present of it, Mars Hill Audio Journal. There was a story being told about this little kid who's going to the aquarium, and he's standing in front of this big tank, and this big ray is, you know, kind of gliding in front of him, and he turns to his dad and he says, "Is this real reality?" And his dad says, "Yeah." And he's thinking in his head, why did a kid ask that? But then you realize what the kid's life is like before coming to this thing, and you understand where he's coming from. The kid got up sometime early in the morning, right? Mom woke him up. He came down, he sat down at a table, and he's eating probably, you know, Captain Crunch, some of the processed food, something like that. They get in a car, and they drive through a concrete jungle, right, with all kinds of things through the city to get to the aquarium. They walk into the aquarium, and the front of it is full of these flashy posters. It looks just like the movie theater. He's in a room full of people he doesn't know. They buy tickets to go through this. He goes in a long hallway filled with, again, a whole bunch of people he doesn't know, a lot of commotion, other things, and he's standing in front of this tank. And how does he know whether this is like his breakfast, real food, or like the city, real natural order, or like, you know, is this like a movie? I just bought tickets for this. I don't know. And so oftentimes you have to think about what the experience level of a grammar school student is. They've only got a few years under their belt. And so you've got to make it very implicit in what you do and explicit in what you do to kind of draw them in. The high school story is a little different. How many of you know about MATLAB? Anybody know about this? Okay. MATLAB, for those of you who don't know, is a modeling software. You get these cool probes and you get a screen. It's kind of like an iPad. And you gather data with the probes in the MATLAB system. You can actually write codes and do simulations, and it'll gather your data and graph it for you. It'll do all kinds of really cool stuff. MATLAB is good stuff. The problem is that most people use it in reverse. They start with MATLAB, and then they might go build a pendulum. The way you do it is you build the pendulum and you observe it, and then you use MATLAB to extrapolate pendulums that you can't build. What if we make it 2 miles long? I don't know. Let's go find out. Right, we don't have a 2 mile tall school. We can't do so. Let's figure out whether the same law applies. They're using technology in a way that's making the experience virtual, and so the kids never really understand what a pendulum is. You never made one. Make things, right? Don't be a maker space, per se. You don't need to buy a 3D printer and Legos, necessarily. Those have places, but if you think about it, Legos involve assembly, not true design, and oftentimes 3D printers involve telling machine what to do rather than woodworking, right? There's a difference there, right? Try and get your hands on as deep a level of engagement as you can. To borrow a title from Philip K. Dick's story, we can imagine it for you. Those of you who know the movie Total Recall know that that's a play off of Philip K. Dick's story called we can remember that for you, where they sell vacations that they'll download to your brain. You don't even have to go on vacation. You just stop by there after work, and you just spent 2 weeks in the Bahamas. Woohoo! They'll pop it in your brain, costs $500. You go home, you're all rested and relaxed, right, ready to go. Well, if we think about that way with our science education, we want them to get their hands on it. One of my scarier things I saw lately was the virtual sandbox, which is a sandbox on an iPad, and when you scoot your finger in it, it makes the sand move out of the way, and sometimes little sparkles come out. It's really cool. But you don't know anything about sand, dude. You've never done anything with real sand. And to think about a 2-year-old playing with this makes me cry. We need sand. Minecraft. Here's another one. For my 6th graders, I do this thing called the Ancient Technology Project. If you want to learn more about this, come to my next session. I'm going to be profiling it there. It's an 18-week research project where we actually research, and we do all the pieces of STEM. We research, we prototype, design, build, and make a final artifact of a piece of ancient technology out of wood, leather, metal, ancient materials. We have a full-on shop in the science lab. One half has microscopes, the other half has power tools and hand tools. And part of what we do right here is just trying to reclaim that space. But this year I was talking about woodworking. I'm giving them some basic lessons in this. This is how I use a chisel. This is how I use a saw. And they're like, this is so different from Minecraft. And I said, really, tell me about that. Or I said, first off, how many of you guys play Minecraft? Every hand. Boom. Up. Really? What? Gosh, really? Yeah, well, tell me about Minecraft. Well, you start the game, and you're plopped down in this place where there might be some trees. Yeah, what do you do then? Well, you go and you punch the trees, and it breaks them into little cubes. Really? Yeah, and it's weird, too, because the rest of the tree is still suspended in the air. You have to punch up on the tree to get more cubes, and then once you get enough, you can make a table. Okay. So you can imagine the kind of groundwork I had to do to teach them how to make a longbow. Okay, and that was really a good 5 weeks of the experience right there. I had to deprogram what Minecraft had already programmed. And for us, we're like, that is ridiculous. But then you realize the kids I'm working with are only 11, right? Their experience is all of that. And when I ask them at the beginning of it, how many of you ever used hand tools? Only 30% have ever touched a screwdriver. Think about it. And what that means, what's the implication to the orientation to creation, right? God gave us these raw materials and these tools and these abilities to use, but we're not using them. Instead, we're programming pendulums. The narrowing and bottlenecking of sensory information, the screen is only so big, right? Take a look at this. That's all you get. And so if all of your experience is on this little guy, right, then you're not going to have thought even for out here. That's why the city of Sydney is installing traffic lights in the sidewalk. Because people are so consumed by this little spot that they don't look up, and they get hit by cars, right? Maybe that is natural selection, but we'll go around that one in a bit. And finally, yes, I pray for those people, in all honesty. And finally, focal practices and patience. Okay, we're almost to activities here, but you might see why I'm laying this groundwork. Focal practices are things that bring us back to center. Things that bring us back to center. I made you engage in one for 6 minutes a moment ago. Drawing, using your eye, using your hands, connecting the two up. Can I make my hand do what my eyes see and my mind interprets? Okay, that's a focal practice. Gardening is also a focal practice. Jogging is a focal practice. Right? These things that pull us back and kind of integrate us back in. The interesting thing about the word focal is that it also has a Latin connotation. The hearth of the home. The hearth of the home. Ponder for a moment. Back in the day, the fireplace used to be a focal point of the house. It was the place where everyone gathered. Everybody contributed to making it work because you all had to gather wood. It wasn't just up to mom. You had to go out there and do it. Every kid was out there doing it, and it brought you in. When it got dark, everyone went there, and you told stories, and you played music, and you shared your culture. And now today, the fireplace is a television. And instead of sitting facing one another, we face it, and it glows. Right? There's a big difference here. And Sherry Turkle has this great article of a book, I think, called Alone Together, which kind of describes what I'm referring to here. Focal practices are practices of the hearth. They cultivate patience, prudence, temperance, justice, fortitude, right? Faith, hope, and love through the work of the hands is what we're getting at here. So, two things. Be explicit with your narrative framework and implicit with your experience. Tell them the story. Tell them the story. Help them understand how God has ordered this cosmos for us. Right? What is he? Why did he give us senses? Start there. And then what can we do with them that's orderly? Okay, great. And then as you create experiences, do that out of that narrative. What are you trying to let them experience, see, do, feel, go through, so that they really deeply appreciate that narrative? Sometimes, in a biology classroom, it's better to watch the fish swimming in the tank than to dissect the fish. So here are three things that I'm going to offer you today as practices. Okay, and we will still have time to talk after this one. Here are three things that I'm doing at my school, right, the Covenant School in Central Virginia. One is multi-generational gardening, to bring these things back. We realized that we wanted to put gardening in our program, and we wanted to do it literally seed to table. We wanted to have the kids plant their food, work their food, harvest their food, and then eat their food, which is, of course, their favorite part. And if you ever have grown things, you know how much better they taste when you're the one who's grown them. I work for that bean, right? That tomato, I work for that. Right, that's good stuff. And so we put a constellation of things into the program, everything from our second and third graders study Virginia history and Native Americans. And so in the second grade, at the end, they plant the three sisters crops, corn, squash, beans, and they let them grow up, and they harvest them together with the new second graders, now that they're third graders. The next year, they get together and have a big feast, and everyone dresses up, but they are the ones who made the food. And you can understand now why the colonists had such a hard time making food when they're trying to grow European crops in Virginia climate. It doesn't work that way. But you also understand now what the brotherhood was there. That was a total gift, man. You saved our lives, Indians. Thank you for that. All right? And we're going to try and treat you the right way because of it. So in addition to doing that, we have a fifth grade cooking STEM unit where they're actually studying the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics of cooking, which, as you can well imagine, involves biology, chemistry, and physics in a very concentrated form. My sixth graders do a deeper unit called Square Meter of Creation, which, again, I'll profile next time. They literally watch a square meter of the campus through an entire school year, and they watch how it changes from season to season, which is a tremendous change, if you can well imagine. So why multi-generational? Because kids today have lost a sense of mentorship. You may remember that oftentimes today when a kid wants to research something, where do they go? Wikipedia, I heard that. I also heard YouTube, right, between out there and those mumbles. So, yeah, Wikipedia and YouTube. Would you rather learn it from them, or would you rather pull someone who's got 40 years of gardening experience in here to give you a few hands-on lessons and be there and actually develop a relationship with a person, right? And this is kind of the idea. We realized that our grandparents wanted to help, and they had tons of time and experience on their hand. They're older. They have tons of time doing this, and they were doing nothing. They were at home. They came in for grandparents' day, one day out of the year, and yet you're our family. And so we said, come in. Come in, find a grade level. We'll pair you up with someone who's interested. You like flowers? Okay, well, you know, kindergarten's doing a flower unit. Why don't we pull you in for that one? You like doing vegetables because you got to do the potlatch? Okay, vegetable gardener, we're going to hook you up with the right people here. We took an interest survey just to figure out who knew what. We even had some landscape architects amongst our grandparents, and we said, can you come help us make the front of the building look better, and I'll give you all the labor you need. That sixth grade class right there, those boys, yep, they're yours. Go for it. You got them. We'll give them the orange suits and everything. They're good. So The whole point was you're using the whole constellation of resources there to build some lessons that might not otherwise be done. I can tell you how to make a plant, but what if grandfather here, who's done this for a long time, comes in and gets to share with you? It makes him feel that much better. It's building a mentorship that otherwise you might not get. You know, a lot of times today kids think mentorship means someone helps me express myself. Right? Think about that. What was the old model? It was apprenticeship, where you actually discipolo yourself to someone. You discipline yourself under someone's tutelage to achieve a journeyman status. You're not even a master yet, man. You got a while to go. And that's a good one to have. Here's the guy who's in charge of this. This is my fifth grade science teacher, Brennan Schmidt, and this is a dad over here on the side, and his two younger sons who do not go to our school, but that not then, but they did now, in part because of this program. And you can see that we have started with garden beds, but then we made a field space. A kid needed an Eagle Scout project. I said, build us a field, right? We'll give you the tools. We'll give you all the materials. You come in, provide the manpower to do it. It was one of the best things that we've done. So multi-generational gardening and sketching practice, just like I put you through. And we do it all over the place. The sketching practice comes in whether we're out there studying things in the garden or whether I do an exercise in perspective at the beginning of my sixth grade science unit where I put a still life in the center of this large rectangular table and the kids all take their seats and I give them paper and I say, okay, sketch it. All right, and you can imagine, because they're all looking at it from different vantage points from the table, all the sketches are a little different. And so I walk around and say, put a 1 on your paper, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We go out and we line them up on a lunch table. And I say, hey, you know, what you guys just did is like that thing in the movies where someone flies up in the air and then it seems to circle around them and then they keep going. Right? You guys have all seen that technique. Cause, oh, yeah. Well, they do that with a circle of cameras and it's just like what you just did right there. So what? Why? Why did I have you do this? It's a matter of perspective. Some of you might not even see this thing that's being blocked by your view here. Others will see it. And that's one of the reasons why we have to work collaboratively. Right? Build up the culture from the very beginning. But sketching also trains you to see. You notice what happened to your mind. You notice what happened to your hand. As you got more details in there, you started to go. And, of course, you can imagine this is very important, never to quit, right? Good piece of music, good piece of sketching is never done. It's always abandoned. Or you can always come back to it and make it that much more real or that much more good. Here's a group of my kids out in midwinter doing the square meter of creation unit. Each of them has their pet square meter, and they're out there sketching. They're sketching what looks like dead ground, because they have to realize that even in that dead ground, they can dig through the mulch at the bottom and find living little green plants waiting to come up in central Virginia in December. It is what it is, and they had never noticed this before. I spread them out so they can't talk to one another or communicate with one another. They're all kind of in isolation. It's very monastic. But they still out just the way you do. The first 3 minutes of total fidgets out there, right? Getting comfortable and finding the right place and one last woo over there, and then all of a sudden it's quiet. And they get into that. And no one falls asleep. It's not a sleepy quiet. So here's a little bit more developed piece. Skills of the tracker. And I don't know if you can see this little fella down here. That's why I do this unit. Right there. Okay? That is a face of wonder. Right here. The bird that we had been tracking by sound through the courtyard just landed above me in the tree. That bird was just as curious about this group of first graders as they were about him. And this was magical. About 3 weeks ago, I had the experience of walking a couple of first graders quietly up to a groundhog hole and having four baby groundhog heads pop out at the same time. And they're like, ugh! And they froze. And it was exactly the right response, right? Because there was this good 5 seconds of where everyone was checking everyone else out, and all the little heads went right down the hole again. I said, well, you saw exactly what you came to see. That was it. So Skills of the Tracker is part of our larger initiative to pull this back, and I've written this curriculum across the last 3 years. I started it with first grade. Now it's in first, second, and third grade. And just to give you an idea of how you can do real modern science but just change the narrative, I'm putting this in for you. Okay? Our youngest learners take in through the senses. They understand through story. They're looking for order. Perfect. That's exactly where you want them to be. We start, well, here are essential questions. Anybody in here use understanding by design as part of their thing? Okay, so you would know about reverse design. The whole point of understanding by design is you think about where you want them to be at the end of it, and then you make your track back from there. Okay, think about where you want them to be and go back. And part of that is creating essential questions. These are questions that cannot be answered in a simple yes, no, or an essay format. They're big. You could pursue them your entire life and still not have full answers to them. These are the 5 essential questions that we actually pose to first graders in this unit. And, of course, there's some things in here that they're not really primed to get yet at first, but you're sowing seeds. And by the end of the year, they're able to give you some good conversation on these. We start with a book, because kids love stories. Owl Moon, Dane Yolen. One of the best books I have in my library. I loved it with my own kids, and I shared it with the school. Owl Moon is all about a little girl who goes owling with her father. It's the depths of winter. There's snow on the ground. They live on a farm way out by the countryside, and there's woods right next to that farm. And Dad takes her out to call in an owl. And you can do that. I have done that before. I've almost got my head taken off once or twice by it, too, because they do get aggressive sometimes of the year. Owls will respond to a call, and the whole point of this journey is to get her out there in the woods, and Dad makes the owl call, and the girl has to continue trumping after him, and it has pages that say, well, when you're owling, you have to be brave, and I'm out there in the dark. And it gives these beautiful poetic descriptions of we came to a clearing in the woods, and the snow underneath was in the moonlight, was as white as the milk in my cereal bowl. You know, things that little kids can identify with and really get that poetry. You have to make your own heat, right? You can't just sit there and be cold out there. You gotta stifle, right? You can't call out. You gotta be quiet. But the big thing is the relationship. Look at how this story to those little kids frames up the mentorship. You have a teacher who's guiding you along, someone you can trust, right? I have plans to prosper you, right? You can trust me. Walk with me through this journey, right? And so once they learn through Owl Moon about the fact that you've got to be silent and you got to be brave and you got to make your own heat and you got all these little basic things about tracking, then I take them outside and teach them techniques. In this case, they're learning deer ears. You ready? You do it. Deer ears are, you only have this much gathering power for your ears. So cup your ears and make them bigger. Can you hear me? Listen to how the treble range changes, right? You can hear that one way up there. You can even hear behind yourself. If you turn them around, I'll bounce my voice off the back wall, and you can catch the distance and the echo there. You can hear two directions at once if you really want to do that. It's a lot of fun. So this was the first lesson in deer ears. I took them outside to show them that, hey, you can do this. Why don't we focus on the garbage truck that's coming down the street? Okay, everybody listen to the garbage truck. There it goes down there. Okay, now turn away from the garbage truck. Can you still hear it? Yeah. But, okay, now close your eyes and find the garbage truck with your ears. You see them all pivot around like that. There it is. And so training those senses by giving them a little tool to extend those senses all of a sudden makes it magical. And we prime this by saying, you know, God gave you senses so you can appreciate this creation. You're looking for order out there. What did you just learn by doing this? Well, we can hear things a little bit further away. Then we can get more stories. That's exactly right. That's where I want you to go. So we're going to start listening to the stories of the squirrels. I want you guys to figure out where all the squirrels on this campus live today by using your deer ears. I want you to figure out where the birds are nesting by using your deer ears. Can you do it? Well, I don't know how to. Okay, well, why don't we just walk around and listen and see if we can figure it out. I'm not front-loading the facts here. Birds live in nests, and they collect things to make those nests, and squirrels have some. No, you don't need to. Just walk around, and when the wonder catches, then you can introduce the facts that give a little bit of story and background. Here we are tracking by the dumpster, which is an awesome place to observe nature. We made a tracking pit back there with wet sand on the ground and tracked the two possums, raccoon, and a skunk that show up at that dumpster every week. That's good stuff. Right, and they notice raccoons have hands like us. Yes, but not exactly. What you might not know about raccoons is that a big portion of their brain, you know how this big portion of our brain is dedicated to sight? As much of their brain is dedicated to touch. And so raccoons are touchy-feely. They can do things with their hands that you cannot do except with your vision, because you have all this power that God has given you to see that. But why do you think God put our eyes in the front of our head? Right? Think about just the discussions you can have about this. Okay, so they're practicing in the field, they're going out there, but then we come back to the classroom, and we pull out the field guides. You saw that bird out there, you remember what that bird looked like? Yeah, it was red, and it had red on the bottom. Why don't we go see what it was? And now all of a sudden they're primed for reading, and using dichotomous keys. First graders who could, I used a dichotomous key to discover what, yep, absolutely you did. That is something really neat and technical. They draw. They come back to the classroom and draw from memory now, because that picture is in the head and we tease it out. We list our questions so that we know what we're exploring. And the teacher, of course, has a guide about where they generally want to go, but it's not super specific. It allows for the kind of fuzzy messiness that makes for good education on the edges, right? You don't want fuzzy mess at the core, but the edges, that's a perfect place to have it. Bless you. bird houses and bird feeders. You see hummingbirds here. You see all of our songbirds coming in. This year on that tree to the right, just behind that hummingbird feeder, robins decided to make their nest. It was a safe enough space in their estimation that they could do it. So they had a bird's nest right outside the window. They hatched the birds. They went out, picked up the egg parts. They had fledglings. It was great. So again, skills of the tracker 2 and 3, where do we take them from there? Well, we constantly reinforce the skills that came before because they play off of things. This year, skills of the tracker 2 did sun posts. We track sun motion across seasons. And we looked at seasonal motions of sun and moon. Why do you see the moon half the time of the month during the day? Some of them were like, what? There it is. Ah, mind blown, right? And immediately you've got people's attention, and there you can work with that. Okay, so why did God order it that way? Why are there bigger cycles and little cycles? What does this mean? Hey, do you realize that one of these is the clock cycle and the other is the calendar cycle? Figure out which one's which. Right? Well, I use GPS to get around. I use the sun and a shadow. Right? I don't need batteries. I'm good. So, skills of the tracker 3 is coming in this year, and we're actually having our third graders build fire by friction. You're tracking materials now. Now you're getting the understanding of why God made woods in different ways. Because cherry is an oak, or pine, or anything else. There's differences here. Why would he do that? What does that mean in providence? He loves us so much that he created hundreds of types of this stuff to be out there, right? And of course, we go out all season and all weather. We had a snow hike last year that was awesome. And it actually ended in sledding, which is a good way to go. So here are the rigorous science skills, incidentally, contained within this. Observation, induction, deduction, you can read down the list. The whole thing is there. Right? This is rigorous science. If I put this next to the core standards for Virginia, I hit them all, and then some. But to what did it beckon? There's your difference. And I encourage you to think that one through. Okay, so as I close this one down, we're just about at time, and I'll leave time for questions on this one. I'll leave with a couple of questions. As you leave here, here are some things you can talk about over dinner. If you have any brain cells left at the end of these days. I know how this goes. What is a redeemed Christian classical model of science pedagogy, and how do we get there from here? Because we're here right now. How do we get there? What are we doing right now and why? Take a survey. Inventory. Your stuff. What philosophies are guiding our practices? Why are you doing it? Okay. If we could change one thing, start small, what would it be? And precisely why would we change it? Because inevitably, not only do you need to ask yourself why, but your parents will ask too. Okay. And who can we work on with this project? Don't go it alone. Many heads are far better than one. Guys, God bless, and thank you for being here. If you have questions, please.